Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I am here with Laurent Pintoni, who is the author of Bedroom Beats and B-Sides, Instrumental Hip-Hop and Electronic Music at the Turn of the Century. Thanks for being here with me, Laurent.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I want you to start by talking about how this book came to be.
Sure.
I know it's a very long process, right? It's over 10 years of writing, but
pretty much. Yeah, it's a convoluted story. I guess the short of it is that it's the result of like pretty much the entirety of my teenage and adult experiences with music. But more concretely, it started about 13 years ago when I was living in Japan. And it started with kind of this idea about instrumental hip hop and electronic music, things that were happening back then, and which I was kind of witnessing from a distance because I was living in Tokyo at the time. And even though we had the internet, this was kind of peak MySpace era. You know, there was still a degree of like removal from physical scene, so to speak. So anyways, had this idea. This idea became a series of articles for a Spanish magazine that I used to write for at the time. Then in 2009, the ideas behind the article got turned into a mix, which I did with two friends of mine, which was kind of trying to... I've often felt like sometimes words aren't enough and the music kind of speaks for itself. And the mix was kind of that. It was trying to kind of get this idea across with just the music. And this was an idea with regards to kind of where instrumental hip hop was at that time, so late 2000s, and its relationship to things that happened in the 90s, and which I guess was the hip hop sound that I had grown up with, which is known as kind of the boom bap sound or the boom bap aesthetic, which is kind of predominantly attached to producers and artists from New York City or from the East Coast. So anyways, we did the mix that was cool. And then a couple of years later, I had a friend of a friend who had moved to Berlin and opened up a space there and was asking people who were interested in coming to do presentations on kind of like modern music history. And the idea kind of through that, I kind of got the idea of taking the mix and the articles that had inspired the mix and kind of turning all those into a presentation and sort of kind of pushing the ball, the big rock further up the mountain. So I did that in like early 2012. That was January 2012. That was in Berlin. And then I took that around in Europe. I did a presentation in Limerick in Ireland, did one in Cologne in Germany, and one in Italy. And it was during my time in Berlin, the first time around, that I kind of randomly met somebody and they were like, I kind of told them why I was there. And they were like, oh, you should write a book. And the idea felt very odd and alien. But then as I kept doing these presentations and sort of like thinking about all the things that I couldn't mention in a kind of hour. It was like an hour and a half presentation. So as I thought about all the things that I couldn't fit into that, the idea of a book started to make more sense. And so that's when that started. And that was 2012. And then it took another 8 years for it to be fully realized. And that was largely because of life, amongst other things. And also, I kind of didn't know what I was doing. But the 8 years, kind of 2012 to when the book was published, which was 2 months ago, and I finished writing it in August this year. So that 8 year period was really just actual research, a lot of traveling, a lot of interviewing, and a lot of reading, researching, writing, not being happy with the writing, giving up, trying again, giving up, trying again, until I just kind of did it. That's a very not short version of the story.
You set this up as sort of a mixtape. So can you talk a little bit about how you've sort of structured the book, your and sort of the setup of it?
Sure. I guess part of the... I really struggled for a long time with how to present the story. I guess this is as good a time as any to kind of explain to people what the book is actually about. The short of it is the book is an attempt at sort of telling the stories behind the evolution of the kind of what's been referred to as instrumental hip-hop and instrumental electronic music, which sounds a bit like a, I guess, an oxymoron. But the kind of instrumental movements of the last 30 years. And for a very long time, I struggled with how to present it because essentially this is a story about hip hop and it's a story about electronic music, but they're not separate. They are the same thing. Hip hop is electronic music. Electronic music is hip hop. And so it was this thing of like, to me, that makes a lot of sense. And I don't know, for some reason, I always kind of felt that trying to explain it in a very straightforward manner, I don't know, for some reason it didn't kind of quite connect, but eventually I kind of got over that particular hurdle. And so the way, I guess one of the ways that I got over that hurdle was by deciding to treat the book not as a traditional book. And so the idea was to treat the book as a, in a sense, as a, in a way as a piece of music. And the format for that is it's actually a beat tape, not a mixtape. The beat tape is the kind of most essential format to the story that I'm telling. And for those who don't know, a beat tape is basically a sort of collection of demos that producers in hip hop largely would use to both practice, that is, they would make beats and put them on a tape, and that was kind of like their gymnastics, so to speak. But then also was used as, you know, a way to shop your business around. So that is, you know, once you had a beat tape that you felt was perhaps most representative of where you were at a certain point in time or whatever, you would use that to pass to A&Rs at labels or to give to MCs. And so the beat tape is kind of this integral part of the story, and it has evolved over the last 30 years into a kind of release format of its own, where like originally it was this thing that was kind of very private and only a few people would have, you know, certain producers' beat tapes, and it was very much used either for personal use or for like business use. And then this largely happened through the democratization of music making and the kind of communication technology that the internet provided. The beat tape kind of then became a format of its own. That is, people were just releasing beat tapes and people were buying beat tapes, and then it was just like a thing. And now it's very common, and you actually see it in a lot of places that you wouldn't expect to see it, so to speak. So you'll see certain musicians that are not necessarily producers, you know, doing beat tapes or whatever. So the beat tape just felt like, it just felt like an easy way to tell the story by freeing me from all the things that I was worried about essentially. So I decided that the book itself is a collection of B-tapes. Originally, the book itself was going to be a B-tape and the different chapters were kind of going to be tracks, but that original idea sort of fell by the wayside for various reasons. So what I decided to do is that every chapter in the book is a B-tape. And what that means is that I'm giving myself the permission to skip around and jump and do things that, narratively speaking, probably aren't, you know, super common. Secondly, it was also a way for me to use the music that I'm talking about as a way to split the narrative. So, in, you know, you would traditionally in the book, you have a chapter and then you might have like subheaders that divide the chapter into various sections. And generally, these have titles that are relevant to whatever you're talking about. And I decided to do that, but that the subheaders would be track titles and that these track titles would generally be relevant to what I'm talking about. And that they would also be kind of presented with the name of the producer responsible for the track. So not the artist necessarily, like, you know, if it was a, for example, the song by a hip hop artist, it wouldn't be like Busta Rhymes or whatever. It would be the person who produced it, whose name would be attached to the track. And that was a way to, again, further sort of allow me to do things that I wanted to do with regards to mentioning things that I didn't necessarily have time to go into details about. And then also essentially offer the reader a way to soundtrack the listening. So that's basically what I did. The way that I explained it at the beginning of the book is that books can sometimes feel very stuffy and straight, and beat tapes are fun. And I kind of wanted this book to be fun. And so I decided to treat it like that. And that's definitely something that I feel, you know, comes from hip hop and the fact that hip hop has taught me as a person, as a fan, as a listener, to be kind of irreverential with subject matter, you know, and to have fun with things and not take things so seriously, I guess.
And so you've got like 21 different tapes in your book, mm-hmm. but you sort of talk about some of what you talk about in tape one, but I'm hoping you can talk a little, because I think they're both important for the book, about King Tubby and Roz G, who you mention in the first tape. So can you talk a little bit about both of them and sort of their impact on the instrumental hip hop and just hip hop in general?
Yeah, sure. I guess one of the things that I forgot to mention when I answered the last question is that so that the chapters are beat tapes and the chapters are titled after albums that do exist. And again, that's another way to sort of like add another layer of sort of intertextuality to the whole thing. So in this case, what you're talking about is, yeah, the first chapter, the first tape in the book tries to give a potted history of the producer in music. The producer in music is sort of like very much one of the main through lines of the book. The book's about instrumental hip hop and the nature of music. It's about this idea of the producer as artist, and it's about technology and how technology sort of allowed this evolution of both the music and the producer as artist. Tubby is important in that regard. And Tubby is really a kind of proxy for the Jamaican music industry of his time. So, you know, I don't want it to feel like it's just Tubby on its own. It's Tubby, it's Lee Perry, it's Jammy, it's all these incredible producers and engineers and musicians. Sly and Robbie, people like that. But so Tubby and Jamaica are important because I guess the way that I put it in that chapter and it's kind of a through line also in the book is that you have on one side the evolution of, so, you know, you have a sort of parallel evolution of the producer in music since the kind of mid 20th century. And on one side, essentially, you have the kind of Western version of that evolution. And that's people like George Martin, who was responsible for the Beatles, for producing the Beatles records. people like Led Zeppelin, as well as, you know, all these experimental artists who worked in the early days of what's came to be known as electronic music. So people like Delia Derbyshire, who was at the BBC Radiophonic Workshop in England. In the US, you had the San Francisco, I believe it's called the San Francisco Tape Center. In France, you had another equivalent, the name of which escapes me, but it was like France, Germany, England, America, were the sort of like centers for, you know, musique concrète, tape experiments, all these early experiments in synthesizers, in electronic music. And that, you know, really helped push what is, you know, helped push where we are musically along. But I think it's a very sort of traditionally, it's a very sort of traditional approach that is kind of very cerebral. It's very cerebral. It's very much about, you know, this idea of practice and all these kind of fancy ideas. And then on the flip side of that, you have similar developments in Jamaica, where in the West, people are turning the studio into an instrument to make pop records. Whilst in Jamaica, they're turning the studio as an instrument. They're turning the studio into an instrument to make music that for them is a liberation from what's happening in their day-to-day life, which was, you know, Jamaica is very kind of was going through a lot at that period. This is like in the 70s, 60s, 70s. And the music was a release from the kind of day-to-day pressure of politics, of the reality of like colonization and decolonization. And so with Tubby, you know, who's wildly, who's generally heralded as the kind of godfather of dub music, and certainly one of its most important figures, what he managed and what him and his peers managed was to take the pressure of their daily life and turn that into music that was very impactful and that used the studio as an instrument. But whereas in the West, it was quite common to use all these tools to layer things, they were actually stripping things back. And I make a reference to, I think it's Brian Eno, who wrote about this kind of early on in the 70s. And he was talking about dub as sculpture, where you're basically chipping away at the kind of musical material. So that's the importance of Tubby. Tubby and dub really kind of gave us, gave modern music an aesthetic that is super important in how it treats the studio as an instrument, especially the mixing desk, especially the use of effects, but also how it kind of treats this idea of music as a living thing that you can manipulate. So that's Tubby's importance. That's Jamaica's importance to the story. As for Ras G, G is somebody who it was a friend of mine. He passed away last year in July. It was unexpected, and it kind of took many of us who knew him by surprise. G was a musician, DJ, producer, worked at a record store in Los Angeles. Was an LA native, born and bred, and he was a part of the musical movement that the book deals with. And G was somebody that I met early on in my research. I interviewed him like 3 or 4 times. We became sort of like friends. We hung out a bunch of times, both in Europe and in the US. And he was somebody who, in a way, I always felt like he kind of understood what I was trying to do. It was this kind of thing where it really felt like he kind of got where I was coming from. And when I heard that he had passed, it really shook me. And on top of that, I was actually I was writing about him when it happened. And I had spoken to him like a week before he passed. And so his death kind of really helped kick me into gear in terms of getting the book finished. I dedicated the book to him. And he is kind of mentioned at the beginning. And then again, the last sort of chapter is dedicated to him. It's a kind of series of letters that I wrote to him. But actually G is kind of definitely related to Tubby and people like that in the sense that he was somebody who made use of his instrument, made use of his tools in a very sort of, in a very dub way. He didn't overthink things. He worked with feeling a lot. he was very much about stripping things down rather than adding. And so, you know, but I think he's important as a sort of, as a spirit guide, if you will, for both myself trying to tell the story and for the story itself.
So another place that comes up and is sort of important throughout the book is Detroit.
Yep.
And so can you talk a bit about Detroit and sort of the role of Detroit in this narrative?
Yeah, sure. sorry. So Detroit is one of a few kind of, I guess, key geographical points in our story. I mean, it's funny to me because, you know, I'm French originally, and I've lived most of my life in England and America and abroad. To me, Detroit is so obviously important because I think if you have any sort of basic knowledge of the history of electronic music, you should know why Detroit is important. But I also, as you know, as I came to learn in my life, like for a lot of American people, like that's not a given at all. You know, where I come from in Europe, there's perhaps more of a tendency to like celebrate the things that come from country X, Y, or Z, or city X, Y, or Z, or whatever. Certainly, I think in America, that hasn't always been the case when it comes to modern culture and modern music. And so Detroit, Chicago, people, places like that are not necessarily obvious to American people as hugely important. But Detroit is hugely important. It's hugely important because it's a city that's full of musicians. It's incredible. As a friend of mine put it, it's the keep it real capital of America. People there are always doing things. They're always sort of active in each other's business when it comes to music. That means, you know, exchanging ideas, collaborating, playing with each other, performing with each other, supporting each other. And so Detroit has, you know, from Motown and even before, all the way to today, just been this incredible musical engine, to kind of use the very overused car metaphor. In the case of my particular story, you know, this is about instrumental music, and Detroit has had a huge contribution to that through obviously techno, but also through various individuals who have contributed greatly to the kind of modern canon of both instrumental hip hop and electronic music. One of which is James Yancey, who is best known to most people as JD or J Dilla, and who is sadly no longer with us. So that's kind of Detroit's importance. And from kind of that, it reverberates throughout the sort of Detroit metropolitan area and its suburbs, Ann Arbor, which is about 40 minutes outside of Detroit, and we believe is where the University of Michigan campus is. It's kind of also an important city, and there's this kind of like relationship between Ann Arbor and Detroit where there's a kind of constant conversation between the two places, both physically and kind of musically. There are artists that have come out of the area and labels, including Ghostly International is one of those labels. Dabri is one of these artists, a guy called Tad Mullenix, who goes by Dabri and a bunch of other names. And so there's this kind of dynamic between the two things. And so Detroit is very much kind of central to the story for that reason. And, you know, it's, I guess it's this thing of Detroit gives a lot, has given a lot, and continues to give a lot to the world. But I think it often gets kind of like sidetracked because it's not as sexy as a lot of other places. I think the same could be said about Chicago to a degree. You know, there's a sort of wider conversation about post-industrial cities to be had there, which I don't really get into too much in the book. But for example, there's a book also by the same publisher that put mine out, Velocity Press, came out last year called Join the Future. I think you spoke to Matt who wrote it. And Join the Future is about what happened in Sheffield in England and the sort of sounds that came out of Sheffield that were inspired by techno, amongst other things. And so Sheffield is also a post-industrial city. And I think there's very much something there with kind of these post-industrial cities that kind of gave very important contributions to modern music, but which by virtue of becoming dilapidated and abandoned socially, politically, economically, they don't have the pull of like a New York City or Los Angeles or London or Tokyo or other media centers, so to speak.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And there are some other cities that you sort of mentioned throughout, like you just mentioned Los Angeles, right? So you talk about Los Angeles as well and the role of Los Angeles. So I don't know if you want to talk a bit about LA or some of the other cities that you saw that were really sort of instrumental to this movement and to this music.
Sure. Yes, yeah, so as I said, Detroit is kind of one of various geographical locations in the book. I think, in a sense, the key geographical locations are like there's Bristol, London, and Manchester in England. I kind of touch mainly on London. I touch a little bit on Bristol and a little bit on Manchester, but I wasn't able to kind of, Manchester comes back into the picture later on, and I wasn't able to get to that, unfortunately. Then you have Paris in France, and then you have Berlin in Germany, Cologne as well. And again, I wasn't able to make too much of those two things because they're kind of more central to what happened in the 2010s. And I'd originally intended for the book to also cover the 2010s quite in depth, but just ran out of space. And then in the US, sorry, in North America, there is Montreal in Canada, Detroit, New York, Miami, Chicago, Los Angeles. Miami, Chicago is kind of like an axis that is relevant to what is known as IDM, intelligent dance music, which was one of the many scenes that kind of helped push this instrumental sound forward. And there was a sort of dynamic happening between Miami. Miami is important because of the Winter Music Conference that used to take place there. It was always a kind of industry city, so to speak. Chicago also sort of involved in it because, like Detroit, it's, as I mentioned, sort of like a, it's just a music city, you know, starting with house music, obviously, in the case of our story. But then the whole bunch of things that happened in the 90s with what kind of came known as post-rock. So this was kind of like the indie rock music with electronic touches. And then Los Angeles is arguably the most, it's arguably the most important kind of city in the book. That sort of happened by chance, but also because it's just, it's something about LA where there's just a lot of people in this story that are either based in LA or worked in LA or are attached to LA by virtue of where or how they release their music. And then also, I ended up moving to LA in 2017 and lived there for 3 years. And I think that was kind of, that happened by fluke, but I think that kind of impacted me quite a bit. But yeah, LA is important, really, again, by kind of the sheer volume of music and artists that were concentrated in and around it. And then more practically, in the case of our story, the way that the story develops from the 90s to the end of the 2000s and on into the 2010s, LA becomes a focus because it is where there's a specific club night. It was called Loewen Theory. That ran weekly from October 2006 until 2 years ago. I think it was August 2018 or 2019, I forget. I think it was 2019. So they ran for about 12 years straight every week. And really what that did was create a place where you knew that every Wednesday, if you were in Los Angeles, you could go there and you would see the same people. And by that, I mean artists, DJs, producers, label people. And you would hear the freshest new music that was kind of within this realm of beats, what I call beat culture in the book. So kind of instrumental hip hop, electronic music. And, you know, that's a very powerful thing. And it happened in London. It happened in New York. It happened in Montreal. It happened in Glasgow. It happened in a bunch of other places. But in LA, it happened regularly for 12 years. And that's really where the city sort of rose in importance. And then, you know, there's a whole, like Detroit, there's a wealth of history in LA before it. So that's kind of what made LA very special. I mean, I often joke that I could have written a book just about LA and probably got away with it. But I was very intent to try and kind of place LA and Detroit and these other cities in a wider context of a kind of global movement, which is really, to me, what I witnessed by virtue of my own experiences, which is, you know, I was born and raised in Europe, in France and in Italy. I went to university in England. I lived in England for a while. Then I lived in Japan for a while. Then moved back to Europe. Then I traveled all around Europe. And I witnessed this music. I witnessed what I talk about in the book firsthand. And I saw it everywhere. I saw it all the way, you know, I saw it in Lithuania. I saw it in North America. I saw it in Asia. And so I wanted to try and zoom out as much as I could, but obviously also, like, narratively speaking, you know, you have to kind of focus on specific places, and LA was definitely one of those. And I mean, certainly arguably one of the more important places in this particular narrative. And I still probably only touched on half of what I wanted to touch on, because there's just so much more there.
So one of the things that you mentioned when you talked about LA was sort of the club scene. And that is another really important aspect, right? The club scene and the shows. So can you talk a bit, if you pick and choose, like, some of the shows or the dance halls that you talk about in the book that you sort of think are really important or want to highlight?
Sure. Yeah, you know, the physical aspect of the music was very important. I mean, this is part of the case, part of what the story is about, is the shift that happened at the turn of the century between, to use some slight tired cliches, but, you know, the analog way of doing things and the digital way of doing things. They're useful cliches for this particular argument, but you know, this is a story that happens at that shift in time, at that moment in time when everything is shifting. So in the first part of the book, we're in the 90s and everything is still very much the old way of doing things. The internet exists, but it's not hugely influential outside of providing new means of for people to communicate. And then, you know, turn of the century, we have the shift in music consumption. And then you start to see how that impacts people financially. And then you start to see how that then leads to a new generation through early social networks like MySpace, developing new ways to communicate, new ways to collaborate, new ways to release, new ways to perform. But throughout all this, despite the kind of importance of the internet and the laptop and all of these kind of digital things, music making software, all of these things, aside from that, there is still a physical element that is people are making these connections digitally, but then they're getting together physically. And that happens in record shops and that happens in nightclubs. And in terms of nightclubs, I mentioned Low in Theory in Los Angeles. That's probably the one that most people would know, but I would argue that there were many others that were just as important, though they were perhaps, well, not perhaps, they were definitely more short-lived. One of the ones that I talk about in the book is Plastic People in London, which is actually a nightclub, not a club night. Plastic was arguably as long-lived as Low End because it lasted for about 20 years. Plastic was super important for London, and it's where a lot of different scenes kind of came to fruition, including dubstep and grime. More specifically to my story, there was a club night in, there was a couple of club nights in Montreal. One was called Bounce Le Gros, which was kind of hosted by Ghislain Poirier, who's one of the characters in the book. And that was followed by another one called Turbo Crunk. And those ran from like 05 till 2010. They were super important with regards to kind of tapping into what has now become, I think is quite normal for a lot of people, but back then was still pretty fresh, which was to have club nights that were very broad in their style and aesthetic of what made kind of club music, you know. So we're talking about kind of popular hip hop, but also underground hip hop. And we're talking about popular dance music, but also kind of underground dance music. And we're talking about things being mashed together and being combined, and about new sounds being discovered on the internet and brought into the club. Things from South America, things from other parts of North America, things from Europe. So it's kind of this melting pot of what back then was kind of being called global bass and had various other names. It was all obviously anchored by bass. So again, goes back to Jamaica, goes back to Tubby. It was all anchored in this kind of Jamaican approach to dubbing, mixing, ensuring that there is a lot of bass in the music. And then by this kind of omnivorous approach to rhythm, to samples, to how to perform. And these guys did it really hard for like a few years. And many of the people, I was lucky, I went there in 2008. I went to Turbo Crunk and it was pretty memorable. So those guys did a lot. And then they had a sort of equivalent across the pond, over in Glasgow in Scotland. And this was a night and a collective called Lucky Me, who are still active. And equally, they were coming at it from this perspective of like, we like hip hop and we like dance music and a bunch of other things. And we want to have all of these things coexist together under one roof. And that's really what propelled a lot of, this is kind of the end of the story in my book. As I said, this is kind of what propels what happens in the 2010s. And I was only able to kind of really touch on the 2010s in the last chapter. But then throughout the 2010s, there's a variety of other club nights and festivals and places that kind of carry this. But I think perhaps the way in which you can see the legacy of this is in something like Boiler Room, which might be more known to people. You know, this idea that you can have a streaming platform that airs music and performances, DJ sets, live sets, whatever, from everything from house and techno to cumbia and new sounds coming out of Africa and Asia and weird atonal noise stuff and a jazz band and somebody making live beats and all of these things coexist in one place. And as far as I can tell, for the listeners and the viewers, there is no dissonance in a way that there might have been 10, 15, 20 years ago. And I think that that's really one of the things that is kind of a direct result of what I talk about in my story, which is that these places, these club nights that I talk about in the book, offered some of the early instances of where that happened.
And so one of the other sort of important things is the role of the DJ and the role of the producer. And so, you know, can you talk about a few of those, either producers or DJs that you think are really important or instrumental to the sort of story?
Sure. Yeah, there's a few of them. I think, you know, I mentioned JD earlier on, James Yancey. I think, in a sense, the book makes the argument that JD and one of his closest allies, you could say, or certainly musical friends, musical kin, like musical kin, was a guy called Otis Jackson Jr., best known as Madlib. So Madlib and JD, I think, are arguably the sort of figureheads of what the book deals with, which is this idea of a modern beat culture and kind of beat-centric music. That's by virtue of who they are. And by that, I mean that they're... So Jay's passed, but I'm just going to talk to him. I'm going to talk about him as if he was still with us, because Madlib is still with us. These are two producers who were never in it for the fame and the celebrity and all of these things that we might associate with a career in the arts. They very much are the embodiment of art for art's sake. And what that meant is that, you know, they found their voice and they are unmistakably them. And in the case of Madlib, that continues through to this day. He just released a jazz album the other day. In the case of JD, that manifested in a variety of ways, mainly through the fact that he remains, you know, I think it's largely undeniable, one of the most important producers in hip hop history to this day. I mean, you know, if we were to make a pantheon of hip-hop producers, Jay would be in the top three. And I think if he isn't, then there's a problem with your pantheon, because stylistically, I mean, the range was incredible. He was just able to do things that most people had no conception of how to do, like from a technical point of view. So these two really helped to push things forward, and they really kind of rose together. They both began in the 90s. And then they met at the end. They met at the early 2000s, and then they had about 5 years together before Jay passed. But their time together really kind of helped push them forward as the sort of like figureheads that people were looking to. And then, you know, that continues to this day. I mean, the whole thing that's happening right now around what's called lo-fi hip hop, Jay is often mentioned as one of the pioneers of that sound, even though that's kind of a weird historical faux pas, so to speak. I mean, he wasn't the godfather of that, but I use that as an example. Like, he's still, even though he's been dead 15 years, he's still inspiring people, rightly or wrongly, to make music, to produce, to make beats. And, you know, that torch of theirs kind of still shines. And then there are others that sort of pick that up, because, again, every kind of movement needs a figurehead, whether they want to be one or not. And so in the book, I talk about how at the end of the 2000s and into the 2010s, a new kind of generation of figureheads emerges, and they're sort of represented by another two people. One is Flying Lotus, Steven Ellison from Los Angeles, and the other one is Ross Burchard, whose artist name is Hudson Mohawk, who's from Glasgow. And in their own way, they also represent the kind of continuation of this idea of being the people that are most well known, arguably have the highest profile. And so they're the ones that everybody sort of turns to as a sort of reference point. Even though, again, they're also both, you know, not necessarily putting themselves out there as anything other than who they are. So there's those are some of the people that the book touches on. I mean, there's so many more. It's kind of really hard to pinpoint it. I conducted over 150 interviews for the book. I probably only used about half of those. There's a whole lot of people that I wanted to kind of touch on that I didn't. But I think perhaps what I can say is that, you know, I use these names because they're the names that people will probably are most likely to know. But I think that you get a better picture of why they matter by looking at everybody around them. And there's just so much wealth of talent and approaches and ideas in their orbit. And that kind of constitutes, you know, the rest of the book. There are people like Daedalus, like Ras G, Mike Slott, Fulgence in France, the people in Japan, DJ Mitsuda Beats is one of them. People in Montreal, Ghislain Poirier, who I mentioned earlier on, another guy called 6-2, who's originally from Halifax, I believe. You know, there are people everywhere. And that's what's really, to me, interesting. And I hope that that's kind of what the book manages to get across.
Are there any of the tapes, the chapters that you want to sort of highlight or talk about? Oh, I know we've talked about a number of things that sort of happened throughout or things, but I'm wondering if there's any specific tapes in the book that you want to speak on.
That's a good question. I'm kind of looking at it right now. I mean, I think ultimately I'm proud of all of the stories that I managed to get across. I think, you know, there's some of the tapes definitely are more perhaps personal. So I'm thinking, for example, so the first tape is kind of interwoven with the story of kind of a personal story of how I discovered the music. And then tape 19, Memories of the Future, also has a kind of personal story. And then the last one, which is dedicated to Ras G, those are very important to me for these kind of personal reasons. But overall, no, I'm proud of everything. I think, again, like, I know that there are limitations. I know that there are shortfalls in the book, and I try to be very upfront about those. In the last chapter, you know, I'm not shying away from my own biases as a writer and researcher. I mean, if spending 10 plus years on this project has taught me anything, is that it's given me plenty of occasions to stare my biases in the face and come to understand them for what they are, and to in turn try to, you know, recognize them and face them. And so, for example, I talk about this in the book, you know, there's one of the big things about this story is the imbalance between male and female protagonists. And on one side, that definitely stemmed from a bias on my part originally. But at the same time, there is also just in this particular story that I'm telling, very much for the first 20 years, a lack of women as performers. There are slightly more women, as always, in the back. And that's kind of a recurring story with a lot of the music kind of up until the past decade. And, you know, that was one of the things where I had wished that I had been able to do more about the 2010s, because in the 2010s, it feels like that balance is kind of slightly becoming to be redressed. But equally, you know, there is also a kind of bias as to just me being a white guy from Europe. And so I see this, you know, through my own personal experience. And one of the things that I mentioned is that I hope that by writing this and getting it out there, it shows to people that these stories are just as worthy of a book as anything else. I mean, for me, one of the things that always amazed me as I was going through this is that nobody brought this book before me. Like, I was really shocked that nobody brought this book before me, because to me it was like, why wouldn't you want to write this book? And I feel like, you know, that's probably so many, I have no doubt that a lot of people feel like that. A lot of writers, a lot of people who either want to be writers or are fans or are just engaged critically in music, and especially people who are not men, who are not white men, probably feel that way. And it's like, you can do it, you know, and I just hope that by doing it the way that I did it, I, you know, it's kind of like a stone, and there are other people that can come and put in other stones next to it, and that helps to contribute to a better edifice of stories. Because again, that's also what's really important, is that the stories are disappearing because people are dying, and because the history is being erased through various means, certainly technology. The kind of technological creep that we're living through is one of those things, you know, and that's another thing that's super important for me, and that doing this has really brought into focus. Like when G died, it was this thing of like, he is gone. I can't talk to him anymore. I can't get any more stories out of him. And the stories that I've got, in certain cases, I was the only one who spoke to him about specific things that happened to him. And so like, you know, there's this sort of sense of gravity all of a sudden. And I think that's only going to accelerate because of what's happening. I mean, just literally, I think it was yesterday or the day before, I learned that Leon, this guy called Leon Chu, passed away. And he is a very important figure in the London music scene. He basically was running a place called Music House that cut dub plates for London's dance music DJ scene for 20 years. So, you know, this is a man who had a hand in music, first seat in modern music history in England, in the United Kingdom, and he's gone. And there are two interviews with him online. And so that's a huge repository of knowledge that's just gone. And those are the things that really preoccupy me today. So I've totally gone around the corner from your question, but basically, to me, like, to bring it back, you know, the book is about trying to preserve some of these stories that are now gone, like G's story, and hopefully show that if people have stories or if people are interested in stories, there is a value to these stories being captured. And
so we've been talking for a while, and you sort of get at my sort of final question I usually ask is sort of, what are you working on next? Is there something, you know, I know this just came out and we're in a very interesting point in history in our country, well, in the world, right?
Yeah.
But is there something you're working on now, or something that is going on with this book that you sort of want to, that final shout out?
Yeah, no. I'm not working on anything per se. I left the US. I moved back to Europe for a little bit for personal reasons. I've gone back to school, actually, and I'm studying. I've gone back to school to try and study archival, as it happens. So yes, what I was kind of talking about in the last question is very much sort of, I'm very interested in archival right now, and not archival in the traditional kind of boring, stuffy sense, but in the sense of like, how do we preserve the history of what we have right now? Because to me, things that have happened in the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years are just as important as what's happened in the last 100 years or whatever. Well, 100 years ago, I should say. So that's kind of what I'm focused on right now. And that means I've gone back to school, and that's its own challenge. But I'm not working on anything per se. I'm going to make most of the research from the book available online at some point, hopefully starting this month. If not, it'll be top of the year, and it will be free. My idea with that is, again, to try and sort of recorrect a little bit of the mistakes and things that occurred in the writing of this. I mean, this was the first book that I ever wrote. And like I said, I made a fair amount of mistakes along the way. And I also have a lot of interviews that I wasn't really able to use that I want to be able to share. And in doing so, maybe make a case, a sort of test case for this idea that archives, that we need to preserve our archives better, and that I think music journalists in particular could really stand to think about what it is that they're standing on in terms of their life's work and all these interviews and all these conversations and all these things that they've accumulated over the years and the value that that has and the value that it might have if everything was pulled together in a meaningful way to both preserve it, but then also make it available to other people to use to push things forward. So that's kind of where I'm at. So we'll see. Like you said, it's an interesting time overall, and there's definitely a lot of distractions, like staying alive. But the book seems to have been doing, so far the book's been received really well by both readers and the people who are featured in it. So I'm very grateful for that. And like I said, I hope that it inspires people and makes them think and makes them listen.
So it's been really great talking with you. Again, this is Bedroom Beats and B-Sides by Laurent Fintoni. So thank you so much for speaking with me for New Books Network, New Books and Popular Culture.
Thank you for having me.